people, how you want to be remembered. Your last words, your last words. And I think it's good that when we look at this book, the book of Deuteronomy, that we should remember that this is a will. This is the final will and testimony of the prophet Moses. These are his last words. These are his passing comments. This is his legacy, what he wants to be remembered for, the things that are deep in his heart that he wants to express to the people while he still has time and opportunity to do so. This is Moses' will. You know, the previous books he's written down in there, a chronicle of history or details of law or records of events. But here he is speaking from his heart what he believes, what he sees, talking about his vision, speaking personally, as it were. And he is preaching the word of God to people, isn't he? Moses is quite a remarkable person. I know we've said this before, but when you think about his life, what a remarkable life he lived. I think you can break his life down into three main phases. His education, the first 40 years of his life in Egypt, essentially living as a prince of Egypt, as the film tells us. But we know, don't we, from what Stephen said about him in Acts chapter 7, that he was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. You know, at the top flight, this was like the best education you could possibly get at the time in the world. Highly educated man with huge opportunities, moving in all the circles, you know, with great experience. And I think mighty in word indeed, that phrase that Stephen uses about him suggests that he had military experience and experience of command and rule. Profoundly experienced person. Somebody who succeeded in the city, if I can put it like that. And then also this same man then leaves, doesn't he? And he goes out into Midian, he goes out into the wilderness, and he spends the next 40 years out in the wilderness. A completely different environment. None of the same rules apply. It's all about, you know, getting water and understanding the lay of the land and feeding the flocks and, you know, just nature, working in nature and the different species and creatures that exist and the times and the seasons. And, you know, I don't know if you like this. I mean, that the first part of his life, that was a life in its own right, wasn't it? It's a successful life in its own right. Now he's kind of Bear Grylls. He's kind of also like learned to survive out in the wilderness, and he's done it for 40 years. It's a really heroic. That in itself is a life. And he did all of that before he even started in ministry. Before he even knew the Lord for himself in a personal way. Before he had a call on his life and went into ministry and went down to Egypt again to go and start speaking to people who didn't want to hear what he had to say and having to kind of make his case and full of the Spirit challenge the authorities and challenge his own people and get a response from people, and gradually, bit by bit, the same people who started out by saying things like, you know, who set you over us as judge, start to like, you know, they start to realize this, the God is speaking through this man. And before you know it, he becomes the senior pastor, as it were, of this great nation, and the head of state as well. Not only, he's not just a minister, he's also head of state. There is no state, they're out in the wilderness, so he's by default the head of state as well. What remarkable experience. Three phases, and each one in its own right is a towering life. And he'd been a prodigious writer as well. I don't know, what have you done? What makes me think when I listen, what have I done with my life? What kind of lives are we living, you know? Not to demean us, but just to look at it, to examine, to think about our lives. Think about what we're doing with our lives, how we're spending our time. Here's somebody who really did a huge amount in his life. And of course, there's so importantly to us, the writings he wrote. He was a man who wrote. He sat down, probably in the wilderness period during his ministry years, and wrote these books, these remarkable books, a whole history of the entire history of the children of Israel, going right back into time immemorial, going right back to Adam, you documenting it, doing all the research, putting it all together, showing how the Lord had been working to form the nation over all of this time. Then the book of the law, the book of Exodus, and the record of the events that took place down there, and the details about the tabernacle, and in such fine detail, the technical book, Leviticus, explaining a full manual for the whole priesthood, how they should operate all the festivals and the sacrifices in incredible technical detail. The book of Numbers, a journal of their journeys in the wilderness and the things that God did and taught them through that time. And then this last book. This is the last book, the final part of his opus that he sets in with those other things. We see it there in chapter 29 and verse 1. The land of Moab, Moses made to the people of Israel in the land of Moab beside the covenant that he made with them. Horeb is Exodus, isn't it? The Ten Commandments in Exodus. And now he's written this covenant that he's written in Moab as he's preached this final message, his personal will. What does he want to see happen to all these people? What does he want to see in the future? How does he want to see them to live? What an amazing life. What an absolutely astonishing and amazing life. And every one of us would say, what a productive life. What a fruitful life. And it makes you think. It certainly makes me think, you know, how important it is to live a full and productive life. You know, just think about the things we do that we just don't really need to do. You get on and really do something with your life. We got one life. Really do something with your life. But I want to show you as we go through this, that despite the fact that he's such a towering figure, such a towering person in his own rights, he becomes ever increasingly more aware that in the end, without God, you can do nothing. You can do nothing. It doesn't matter how much education you've got, how much personal experience you've got, the talents that you have, the opportunities you've been given in life. In the end, your legacy, what happens after you've gone, and so on and so forth, it's in God's hands. There's stuff that is just out of our control. And that is really the heart of humility, isn't it? The heart of humility is you realize, do you know, actually, I haven't got the last word. It's God. In the end, whatever's going to happen, whatever usefulness that's going to come out of my life, it's going to be God. And if he doesn't bless it, it won't happen. But if he purposes a thing, it will come to pass. And there's a real sense at the end of this book, he is commending his spirit to God. He's sort of, having done everything he's done, he's finally giving his last addresses to people, his last comments to people, saying the last things to people, and then handing himself over. Look, in the end, this is all in God's hands. Rather like Jesus on the cross. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. In the end, what happens from this point onwards? It's with you, God. And he, of course, is quoting King David from the Psalm 31, verse 5, who in the midst of that psalm describes his own situation. He realizes that this is out of my control. I have to just give myself to God now. I have to give the situation over to God. We've had an opportunity to minister to people today. And you have all sorts of opportunities. But in the end, at a certain point, you do everything you can. It's over to God now. It's that you do so much. Doesn't matter whatever you've contributed. We haven't got the final word. We haven't got the power. The power and the glory is with God. Deuteronomy is essentially a record of Moses' valedictory service. You know, valedictory, I had to look the word up, so if you don't know what it means, don't feel left out, because I had no idea. But it just came to my head, valedictory, and I thought I'd better look it up just before I use it, because it probably means something completely different. But it means your final speeches. Final things that he has to say, and essentially a valedictory service after 40 years of ministry. Imagine, like, the day comes, you've been in ministry for 40 years, you've been working somewhere for 40 years, you've been serving somewhere for 40 years, something that's been the mainstay of your life, the most important thing of your life. The day comes where you know that tomorrow you won't be doing this, and you have an opportunity to stand up and just say something. Say your goodbyes. Say goodbye. That's what he's doing. He's standing up to say goodbye. And it takes the form of these three solemn addresses. And the first of the solemn addresses starts in chapter 1, verse 1. And it starts with a phrase, "And Moses summoned all Israel." And essentially, if I can put it like that, this part of the service was the notices. All right, it does seem to be the basic format of a regular service in this. There's the notices. You've got to have notices. But the notices in that first part, the main notice that is given out, is that Moses tells the people, I am not going with you. Do you remember that when we looked at it together? That was the real shocker. Because they all thought, he's coming with us. We're all going together. He said, no, I'm not going with you. But, of course, at the same time, he informs them as a notice. But Joshua is taking over. He is going to lead. So, second notice. First notice, I'm standing down for ministry. Second notice, Joshua is taking command. So, important notices. And thirdly, in the light of it all, because they're about to enter into Canaan, aren't they? That this changeover, this sudden news, that doesn't mean the invasion is cancelled. It's going ahead just as planned. All right, so that's the notices. I'm not going, he's leading you, and the invasion is happening just as planned. That's really the notices from chapter 1, verse 1 onwards. But then chapter 5, verse 1, then Moses gets up, and now he's preaching. The notices are over, this is the sermon. And we know what the text is, because from chapter 5, verse 1 onwards, he starts with the Ten Commandments, doesn't he? He knows what he's reading. He's gone to Exodus 20. He's read Exodus 20, and he's preaching the Ten Commandments to the people. And there's this long, extended, extempore, expositional sermon on the Ten Commandments. And really, this is the heart and center of what he had to say to them. So I'm not, you know now, I'm not going. You know that Joshua is going to leave me. You know that you're going into the land regardless of all these things. But this is the substance of it. God is going with you. God is going with you. And that is the most important thing that they need to know. And that's what he's preaching. And how will they connect with God? How will they know what God wants them to do? He's given them his word. They have to listen to his word and do it. And God will be with them. That's the substance, I think, in a nutshell, of the second part, the main sermon. And then we get to chapter 29 and verse 2. And there's the beginning of this third section. And just look at it with me and just see that it starts with an invitation, this renewal of the covenant that is the heading that the ESV gives it. There's this invitation to obedience, which he's been speaking about before. And then if you turn over the page in chapter 32, having given out this invitation and this exhortation to obey the covenant and embrace the covenant, you see that in chapter 32, then, what do we normally do after the sermon? We sing a song, we sing a hymn. And so he's written this hymn, and so he teaches them all this song, and they sing together at the end of the sermon. Again, which reminds me of the Lord Jesus in the Last Supper, his will and testimony, his last commands and prayers for the people. He says in Mark, it says, and then he went, and they sang a hymn, and then they went out. There's almost something similar about the shape and the form of these two things. So they sing this song together, and then after we've sung at the end of the meeting, what do we normally do? Somebody prays, yes? And then we find that, don't we? Having finished the song from chapter 33 onwards, in chapter 33 there's this long extended prayer. He prays for them as they go. And after that, the meeting is closed, and Moses goes away, and Moses dies. And there is something about the Lord's Supper, that final evening here, this kind of, especially if you read it in John's Gospel, where he's talking about his will, he's sharing his heart, his desires, he wants them to be one. He wants them to be in God and to God to be in them. He prays for them, doesn't he? They go off, they sing this hymn, they go out, and then he goes out and prays for them at Gethsemane. And then the next thing that happens is that he dies. That he dies. There's almost like a pattern there. In the heart of this exhortation, the encouraging part from chapter 29, verse 2 onwards, this first section of it, there's one phrase that comes up that I think sums up everything that Moses will for those people. He says to them, choose life. Do you remember that expression? Have you come across that expression before? Choose life. Here's somebody who's lived. And what does he want them to do? Choose life. He wants them to live, doesn't he? He doesn't want them to die. He doesn't want them to be cursed. He wants them to go out from this situation and live life to the full. That you might live life in all its abundance. You might just throw yourself into God and trust him and live life to the full. That seems to be the substance of what he wants from them. But even as he's saying these things, there is a shadow that is cast over him in this last section. I'm just giving you an introduction, this last section of the book, and I want to illustrate it to you. Because as he's publicly encouraging them to do this, God starts to speak to him. All the way through the book, we're hearing Moses speak. In this last section, we hear God speaking to Moses as if we've been let in on private things that the Lord is sharing with Moses as he seeks to encourage the people. And chapter 31, verse 16, we get an example of what he is hearing. Chapter 31, verse 16. There he is, throwing it. He's been working up to being in the ministry. Spent 40 years in ministry, serving the Lord. He's preached his heart out. He's preaching his heart out again. He's sharing the word. He's encouraging. He's warning. He's doing everything he can. And then God is taking him aside in chapter 31 and verse 16 and says, "Behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers." He's saying, you know, your strength is running out. You can't keep doing this much longer. The time is coming to an end. And then he says, then this people will rise. And it sounds, oh, great, they're going to rise and they're going to go forth and they will whore after foreign gods. He's done absolutely everything he can. Oh, imperfect as it might be. But he's being told, God is telling him, you know, after all of that, They're not listening. And there's nothing he can do about it. Because as we just read there, you are going to lie down, he says. God said, you know, you are going to die. There's only so much you can do. You've got to go. And you can't control the way this is all going to happen, the way it's all going to work out. Because this, ultimately, it's in God's hands. You do your part. You throw your heart into it. You choose life. But the future and what happens, it's in God's hands. And God is speaking to him towards the end. Chapter 31, verse 14. You can see it there. 31:14. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, the day is approaching where you must die. You must die. You've got to stop. You can't keep going on like this." The pangs, as it were, of death, as he's carrying on in the fullness of his ministry, the most exciting moment, if you like. And then chapter 32, go over there with me, chapter 32, and go into verse 48. After the singing, at the end of the song, this kind of perhaps a euphoric moment, I don't know, but verse 48, "And that very day the Lord spoke to Moses, go out to the Mount Abarim, to Mount Nebo, in the land of Moab, opposite Jericho, which I'm giving to the people, and die on the mountain." It's time. It's time to stop. You can't do any more. It's over. It's over. And having heard these things, he knows. He's done all these things, warning, encouraging, preaching his heart out. He's being told by God there's a limit to what you can do. There's only so far that you can go. And what's his response to that? We see that in chapter 33. He does the same thing, funnily enough, that what Jacob did when, at the end of his life, when he realized his time has come, he gathers his family around him and he prays for them. And he gathers them around and he prays for them. In the end, there's nothing more he can do. You've got to put these things in the hands of God. You do what you can, and then it's over to God. God is God. And all his education, his life experience, and his ministry opportunity, his position of power, in the end, you have to humble yourself and go, in the end, it's all with God. Without him, we can do nothing. Preaching, writing books, singing hymns, praying together. Still, it becomes clear to him that those things are not a formula. We don't do these things, and then there should be a necessary consequence. It's with God, the sovereign Lord, has the final word about what will happen in all of our lives. And so I want to look at just chapter 29 with you very briefly. Just looking at the opening of this section. But this is the substance of what happens in this last section. And despite the fact that it becomes more and more apparent to Moses of his limitations, of his weakness, that there's some places you can't go, there's some things you can't do, Moses doesn't quit. He doesn't get discouraged. He doesn't give up. He just carries on doing those same things, doesn't he? He keeps preaching. He keeps exhorting. He keeps encouraging. He keeps singing and praying, even though he knows that in the end it's all with God. Why? Because he trusts God. Because he knows God. Because God is God. He keeps adding to the word. So in chapter 29, verse 1, there had already been the covenant at Horeb, but he goes ahead and he preaches this sermon and adds the ministry at Moab to it. God has revealed his will, and now he's determined to preach it and tell everybody about it. And as he looks through verse 2 through to 9, in chapter 29, verse 2 through to 9, he goes back and looks over their history, and he points out to them again and again how the Lord saved them. The Lord saved them in Egypt. Why is he saying this? To encourage them. God saves. How the Lord saved them through the wilderness. Their feet, the shoes and their feet didn't even wear out. The love of God was so close to them through that time. And then Gilead as well, the two kings that came out against them, how they defeated the kings. Time and time again, the Lord has saved, the Lord has helped, the Lord has blessed us time and time again. But look in verse 4. He then also reveals to them what God is showing him, that despite the fact that all of these great things that God has done and the things that he's speaking about and all the preaching and all the encouragements right there and then, he still can't make them see it. He can't make them hear it. He can't make them understand these things. Because there are some things that just, it's just God. It's just God. You can't do it by your arguments, by your reason, by your eloquence. It's unless the Lord builds the house, the laborer labors in vain. And from verse 10 through to 15, he then brings them to the purpose and the reason why they're around today, on that particular day. They're there to make a covenant. They're there to come into a relationship with God. And the relationship that's on offer, this special relationship that's on offer, is a relationship, as he stresses through those verses, is with anybody and everybody. Whoever will believe on the name of the Lord, he will save them. Doesn't matter who they are. The little ones and their wives, and, you know, he goes through the whole list. Anybody, even the woodcutter who's sort of standing around at the corner, they're not even part of the congregation, just listening in. If that person will put their trust in God, God will make a covenant with them. He preaches the covenant. He preaches the opportunity to all of them. The door stands open to young and old and rich and poor and native and foreigner. But in the end, the response, who will respond? It's with God. It's with God. And as we go through from verse 16 through to 28, he begins to rehearse the dangers that he has seen. Because they've been traveling, haven't they? And they've traveled through these different countries. They've spent time in Egypt, as is stressed in verses 16 and 17. And the truth is that they know a lot about God's will. They've seen God do great things, but they've also seen other people and the way they live their lives. They've seen other kinds of worship. They've been exposed. You can't keep people in cotton wool. They understand there are other ways to live, that other people live their lives. And what people will finally do, who they will finally serve, who they finally love, you can't control that. It's with God. And here he is offering covenant with the living God to people, an open offer, and all they have to do is trust him. The truth is, there is no window on the soul, is there? You cannot really ever tell what is really going on in somebody's heart. And this goes into verse 18 and 19 when he talks about there might be somebody whose heart is just going away. It may be a whole clan or a tribe, a whole group of people. There might be something going on in their hearts. And you can't tell from the outside. From the outside, they're smiling or looking you in the eye or nodding along. You just don't know, in the end, what is going on in people's hearts. It's a secret place. The heart is a secret place. And you can open your heart and try to be honest and share with people, but there is something impenetrable about a human being. There's a holy of holies that exists in there, and stuff goes on in our hearts, doesn't it? And what he's describing there is that that's where the temptations come. You know stuff, and those words and those experiences you had, they work in your heart. And here he's describing people whose heart just begin to turn away. And, I'm interested. I'd like to try that. I've kind of had enough of this. And you can't control what goes on in people's hearts. You shouldn't even try to. You just share the word. Tell the people the truth. And the secret things, they're out of our power. They're out of our reach. You see sometimes whole nations drift away from the Lord, only through history. It's because something's happened in people's hearts. Sometimes it's an individual or a group. Sometimes whole nations just drift away from the Lord. And there may be fine preaching. There may be good services. There may be a good education on offer. Even have spiritual experiences. But if something gets a hold of a person's heart and takes their heart, there's nothing that can be done. There is nothing that between that what goes on in the heart is between them and God, and nobody can reach. But there is a God, isn't there, who can reach into people's hearts. There is a God who can change people's hearts. As we go on here in verse 21, he talks about the punishments that he will visit upon those whose hearts and drift away from the Lord and go after other gods. And it's pretty clear that people will turn away from the Lord even though they know that the wages of sin is death. Even though they know that this isn't the way everlasting. Even though they know it's for their own destruction. And when judgment falls, as he describes there in verse 25, when finally the judgment falls on people, it's clear to everybody. Why is they? Well, they haven't walked in the Lord's ways. It's so clear. It's so obvious. If you live life God's way, there are blessings to that. But if you go off and be arrogant and selfish, pride cometh before a fall, and everybody says, well, look, we shouldn't be surprised. Even though we know that, what will happen when we entertain sin, what will happen to us when we submit to temptation, people still do it. Once the heart gets attached, they pursue after these things, and it happens. And the final verse really sums it up. Verse 29. There are things that are just a mystery. There are things that are out of control, out of our control. They're not out of God's control, and they're not a mystery to God. God sees what's going on. God knows what's going on. God is in control of what is going on. What do we have? We've just got what we can see. And most preciously, I think Moses is referring to this. We've got the revealed will of God. We don't know who God secretly is determined will move one person's heart this way and another person's heart this way. But what we do know is what he has revealed. That Jesus is Lord. That the gospel is to be preached. That we're to rejoice and sing and pray and do these things. And to keep going forward regardless of what changes come about in the world. We know these things. And Moses is utterly committed to keeping doing these things, knowing that there are some stuff that you just can't touch. And you shouldn't even try. He's been around long enough to know that God is God. And at very best, we are humble servants, his humble servants. Why does one person believe and another one doesn't? Why do you sit in a room, you preach one message, and somebody responds and somebody doesn't? Why? The secret things belong to God. And that's the best place. Have anybody here got any unanswered questions? Anybody here puzzled by some things you've experienced in life? Why did this work out like that? Why did this person and not that? The secret things, they belong to God. But the revealed things, they belong to us. So when somebody makes a profession of faith, when you see people praying and joy, you rejoice in that, don't you? You just throw your arms up. That belongs to us. God has given us these things, and we rejoice in what he gives us, the good things that he gives us. And we carry on serving. And we carry on doing what God has told us to do. But ultimately, it's in the hands of God. It's in the hands of God. Keeps you humble, doesn't it? Keeps you humble. Keeps your attitude and your relationship right He's told us what he wants us to do, how we should live. We've just got to get on and do it. These things have been given to us. The outcome, the answer, it's with the Lord. It's with the Lord. I'm just very heartened by the fact that here's somebody who lived 120 years, had probably one of the richest and fullest lives of any person you can read about in the whole of the Bible. And at the end of his life, it seems it's pretty clear that he knows he's not in charge. Doesn't matter what you've achieved. God is still God. You'll never ever perfect the trick of trying to control people. You'll never be able to control people because people belong to the Lord. They're his treasured possession. And he's a jealous God. We shouldn't try to control people. Just speak the truth. Love people. Serve. The answer is with God. And he carries on, doesn't he? And this is the last thing. When you find yourself walking in obedience, when you find yourself trusting him, when you find yourself serving and with the power and the energy to resist temptation, when you're in that place, that is a gift from God, isn't it? That should make you so, so thankful. Here I am. Today, by God's grace, by his own particular and sovereign design, he, by his grace, has chosen me to do this, to serve him in this way or whatever it might be. I didn't deserve it. It could have been somebody else. It could have been somewhere else. But this is his plan being worked out. And it just makes you thankful, doesn't it? It makes you just fall on the Lord and realize that this is by grace. This is by grace alone. Nobody has a claim or a right to these things. The heart of a king is in the hand of God. He'll divide us and push us wherever he pleases. He is God. So if you find yourself in his house with his people, serving him and loving him, praise the Lord. Praise the Lord for all his mercy and grace. We're going to sing 975, which is Before the Throne of God Above. Before the Throne of God Above. And